Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to a new episode of Talk Back with C.E. Moore. This time around, fiction editor Melissa Willis joins us on the line as we sit down and talk with lawyer turned author Randy Singer about his newest book, The Last Plea Bargain.
Tell us a little bit about The Last Plea Bargain without ruining it for potential readers, obviously.
Yeah, sure. I won't give away the ending, but the premise of the book is that in our criminal justice system, Calvin and Melissa, about 90-something percent of the cases are disposed of by plea bargains, meaning that the defendant pleads guilty in exchange for a lesser sentence, or maybe they testify against another, defendant who's a bigger fish that the prosecutors want to fry, and they get a lesser sentence. And so my thought for this book was, what if the defendants unionized, like we've seen teachers and others, unionize and demand their rights? What if the felons who were in jail said, nobody plea bargains from this day forward. And what if when somebody did plea bargain, they were immediately killed in jail or when they got loose on the streets? It would pretty much shut down the criminal justice system because there wouldn't be enough prosecutors to prosecute these folks. There's not enough judges, courts, there's not enough public defenders. And so the premise for this book is the defendants on the one hand have said no more plea bargains. Our protagonist is a prosecutor, a young prosecutor named Jamie Brock, whose mother was killed in a breaking and entering. And so she doesn't believe in plea bargains anyway. And she gets kind of thrown into the middle of this chaos in Atlanta, where she works as a prosecutor, where basically it's the inmates running the asylum. The defendants have decided no more plea bargains, and it just throws the entire court system into absolute chaos. And in the middle of all of this, Jamie Brock is going to be trying the most important murder case of her life.
Okay.
So now this is second time we visited Jamie. She was also in False Witness.
Right. That's right.
But this is also the second time that you've written a book from a first-person female perspective, self-incrimination being the first. Why did you decide to write Jamie's part in first-person, and what kind of challenges do you face when writing female first-person characters?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, Melissa, just to mention why I brought Jamie back. A lot of times I try to listen to readers when I talk to them about my books, and certain characters pop up in their minds. For some reason, they kind of resonate with certain characters, and they'll say, are you going to bring Quinn Newberg back, from By Reason of Insanity? Are you going to bring this person? And one of the people they're kind of intrigued with is Jamie Brock. And so this was the continuation of her story from False Witness. She becomes a prosecutor, and she's the protagonist. As to the challenges of writing first-person female perspective, I don't remember if you all did an interview after the first time I did this with Self-Incrimination, which was about 6 or 7 books ago. I wrote the entire thing, first person, present tense, from a female protagonist perspective. And I swore after that book, I would never do that again. I said, it was a great challenge. I'm glad I did it, but you'll never see me doing that again, And here I am I think it's like one of those things. If you've ever run a marathon, you get done, you say, oh, I'm glad I did that. I'll never do that again. But then, a few months later, the pain kind of goes away. And in a moment of insanity, you decide to try it again. I do love first person because, to me, it really draws the reader in close to the protagonist. You can really live through that protagonist. What are they seeing? What are they thinking? What are they feeling? But it takes a certain book. My books have a lot of different subplots going on, a lot of intrigue in the background. And first person is somewhat limiting because you're only looking through Jamie's perspective. So it takes a certain kind of story. And when I outlined this story, I just knew as soon as I got the outline done and got the idea for this book, because Jamie is struggling so much with her idea of justice, trying to balance that with grace, I just knew it had to be written from her perspective. And I really even went into it, Melissa, thinking, oh, no, I said I was never going to do this. Here I go again. And sure enough, that's what I did.
It worked. But, just like the first one, it's really funny because when I read Self-Incrimination, it was probably 2 or 3 months later that somebody brought up the fact, well, it was from a first-person female perspective, and Randy Singer isn't female. And I just... you're right. That never even crossed my mind the entire time I was reading that book. It was so well done. It never even crossed my mind. And so I saw this again and I thought, wow, you like a challenge, don't you?
I do. I think the only people that really bothers the most, Melissa, are my friends. They're like, I could not get into this book because I knew you wrote it as first-person female. It's creeping me out, you know. But people that don't know me, hopefully they will have your reaction. They'll just read the book and never really even think about it. And, you know, I do, of course, I have it edited numerous times, and there's many women who, you know, my wife, for example, is an English teacher, and I've got friends that look at these books and give me editing ideas before it even goes to the publisher, and I've got two or three female editors at Tyndale that are helping me with it. So there is a lot of estrogen editing happening.
That's what I was going to ask. I was like, okay, do you like run this by a woman? And she's like, you know, that a woman would never say that. A woman would never react. I don't know. You know, I was wondering if that was part of the process in the editing.
It is. And part of what saves me, Calvin, is Jamie, as you know, is a bit of a tomboy. So yeah. that helps a little bit, you know. But also, I if you were in our house, you'd get a kick out of it because I'm sitting in my study, and then I'll be, hey, Rhonda, you know, what would you think about blah, blah, blah? And I'll just bounce stuff off her all the time and kind of get her reaction to what Jamie would be thinking and feeling here.
That's hilarious. Well, now,
it should frankly help me be a better husband, but I'm not sure it's working. You know,
well, you're still married, so
I'm still married.
Let's talk a little bit about Caleb's clients, because in this book, they kind of have an uncanny knack for beating lie detector tests.
Right.
But there's another test that the character Mace James uses to determine Antoine's guilt or innocence. Talk about this test, the BIOS, the BIOS test. What is it, and how is it currently being used in trials?
That's a great question. One of the things, like what I'll do with a book is I'll have a big idea. And my big idea in this book is this character, Jamie Brock, and her conflict between wanting revenge for her mother's death and wanting to ensure justice is done. So that's kind of the big concept. But then as I'm going through a book, I'll find these intriguing aspects of legal cases and the law, and I'll weave those into the story. And one of the things that I found, in fact, the only negative reaction I've had from advanced readers, Calvin, have been some folks that have said, you know, I was buying everything in the book except for that part about what you just mentioned, this BIOS test and how, you know, planting false memories. It just seemed too much like science fiction. And I laughed and I said, that's the stuff that's just absolutely, totally, 100% real. Everything that I wrote about those tests is actual fact. I just changed the names a little bit, and you know, but it's really happening. So the BIOS test is the lie detector test, as you know, the polygraph measures heartbeat, sweat, you know, nervousness. It's kind of it doesn't really tell whether somebody's lying or not. It just tells how nervous they are, and the assumption is, you know, when we tell lies, most of us get more nervous, except for real accomplished liars. But the BIOS test is a different animal. And what this is supposed to do is it measures your brain activity and your brain waves. And the idea here is with the brain mapping technology we have today, there are certain parts of your brain that that are triggered, certain synapses that are triggered when you've experienced something and you're being asked about something you've experienced, versus when you're being asked about something that is just conceptual to you and that you have not experienced. And so what you can do is you can hook someone up to one of these tests and ask them a question. You know, Calvin, were you in Randy's house the night of July 12th? And watch your brain activity and see which part of your brain responds. And did you carry a gun into that house? And did you shoot Randy's wife? And you can actually, you know, interrogate someone this way. Now, in our country, that can't be done because there's a self-incrimination, obviously, under the Fifth Amendment. But just think how criminal defendants could use a test like that to say, I'm innocent. Look, I've taken this test. My attorney got the foremost expert in the world to give me this test, and it shows that I didn't experience this. Well, the fact of the matter is, in India, that kind of test has already been used to convict someone in India of murder because they don't have those same kind of prohibitions against self-incrimination that we do here in the U.S. So this technology is out there. It's being used in courts in some countries in the world. And, you know, I don't think it'll be long before maybe defense lawyers seize on it here in the United States.
That's really interesting. And I think the really interesting part of it is, I mean, it's kind of like theory, almost like Minority Report. Almost. I mean, not completely like Minority Report, but a
right.
bit like that. It does have that kind of sci-fi feel to it, but
right.
at the same time, I think about some of the authors that we've talked to, Stephen James, Tim Downs comes to mind immediately, talking about sometimes the most unbelievable stuff is the truest stuff and the scariest stuff. Like, could this happen? Yeah, it could happen very easily. There were some creators of a video game called Splinter Cell, and this guy is like a one-man SEAL team, basically. He sneaks in and does all this stuff. And he does all these moves in this video game, and I was watching a video about this on YouTube one time, and the creators of the game were talking about how they went about creating the game, and they had actual Navy SEALs come in and show them different moves, and they would, you know, make the character do this in the game. And they said there were actually things that we couldn't have the character do, not because we would give away, you know, like some secret move that Navy SEALs use, but just because nobody would ever believe that this was humanly possible. No one
right.
would ever believe it. And so that's kind of interesting that, you know, people have responded that way to you in response to adding the BIOS test to this book, something that's real but seems unbelievable.
Right. And just think what a tool that would be for defense attorneys, because really prosecutors can't use it unless the criminal defendant, you know, assents to it. But criminal defense lawyers could use it. So they'd have a tool in their arsenal that the prosecutors wouldn't have, and it could really kind of tip the scales if
right.
this technology became accepted by the court. So it's really kind of an interesting thing to think about and look at.
Okay. Well, now, I love discussing legal stuff. This is always fun to me. Now, I'm a proponent of the death penalty. I live in Texas. Yeah, we execute generously here.
Do you know that Jesus was executed?
Yes, I do. I'm still
false accusations against him executed.
Okay, carrying on. Now, you talk about capital punishment in this book and present some varying views, but what I'd like for you to talk about are some of the questions that you address in this book and what you think about the current system. And do you think the system is unfair, particularly in regards to race?
In particularly in regard to what, Melissa, was the last part of the question?
In regards to race.
Okay, right. Yeah, it's interesting that this book comes out, you know, in March of 2012, but it's written, as you all know, books take a long time, so you write them like a year ahead of time. And about when I had this finished, it was at my editor's, was when the Troy Davis execution went down in Georgia. And this book is about a death penalty case in Georgia.
Yeah.
So I know people are thinking, well, he must have, you know, been inspired by the Troy Davis execution to write this book. But it was actually already done at the time that happened. That just added some kind of details, and, you know, it allowed me to look at it from a little different perspective, but it was already finished. What I've tried to do, as you know, is to present both sides. I've got, just like you all on this phone, it sounds like we've got competing sides to the death penalty, believers on both sides with strong beliefs, personal beliefs, deeply held convictions, both for and against. And what I try to do when I take an issue like the death penalty or in other books, you know, I've addressed other similar kind of hot button issues, gun control, that kind of thing, is I try to present a compelling character for both sides. Because I don't know about you all, but I hate it when, like, I'm watching a game on TV and my team isn't playing. All I want is a close game. I want an exciting finish. You know, I want both teams to play well. And I think in books, it's equally boring for me if the author just presents kind of a one-sided case, because you pretty much know how it's going. So in this case, I wanted to present the kinds of arguments you see on both sides, but not just like esoteric arguments, because this isn't a book about the death penalty. That book's been written 1,000 times. This is a story. And on one side of the story is a victim of, you know, of violence who lost her mother, who's now a prosecutor, who really believes in justice and believes the death penalty is a necessary deterrent as part of that, and wants to see her mother's killer get the ultimate punishment. And on the other side is a lawyer defending this guy who's seen this man be redeemed in jail. He really believes that he's turned around and given his life to Christ. And not only that, but the lawyer himself was a convicted felon who changed spiritually and then went to law school and became a law professor. So they both have, you know, personal skin in the game. They're both very invested in both sides of the argument. And what I like to do is present both sides as strongly as possible, let the reader decide. In terms of my own personal beliefs, I'm not anti-death penalty on a principled basis. In other words, I can defend it biblically based on justice, but I am against the death penalty on a what I would call more of a practical or pragmatic or maybe even experiential basis, in that I've seen the legal system fail too many times, and I've seen too many innocent people, you know, be accused of something and convicted of something they didn't do. And we've all seen it with the DNA evidence we have out now and old convictions being overturned. I don't frankly trust our system enough to allow it to exact the ultimate punishment, which is to kill someone. I mean, you cannot reverse that. And I do think, Melissa, you bring up a great point, that all of the studies show that juries and the entire system ends up being biased on race. That's, you know, a African American who commits a crime against a white person is far more likely to get the death penalty than a white person defendant, and especially if they end up committing a crime against an African American. So with that kind of built-in bias, I just can't justify giving the state the authority to, you know, to pull the switch on that.
Well, I that's one of the things that by the time I finish this book, I still sit back and I said, I'm still a proponent of the death penalty, but I do worry that it's not always right, that people make mistakes. And you know, I think that's a good thing to sit back and have those views challenged. I like that about this book. I like to be challenged on these issues because, you know, I would never want to be the person on the jury that voted yes for a death penalty.
Yeah, and you know, and my hope too, Melissa, is that somebody who came into the book and said, I'm really against the death penalty, might have the same reaction, might say, you know, I'm rethinking the way I felt. I've had my views challenged too, because that was my goal really, is not to have an agenda. But see, I trust my readers. I think my readers are really intelligent. I know they can figure stuff out. And what I do think happens to my readers, because it happens to all of us, is we don't open ourselves up to hear the other side. And so when you're just reading a story, it penetrates your defenses, you know, and kind of just goes right straight to your heart. And then you hear the other side a little more clearly maybe, and it causes you to either clarify your views, solidify them, or say, I should rethink this a little bit. So that's encouraging to hear.
Now, we're kind of running low on time, unfortunately. There are a couple questions that Melissa and I will probably ask you offline. And they won't make the podcast, and so sorry for you people who are listening. But some questions we definitely want to get in here. We want to be careful not to spoil anything for our listeners, obviously. But several times, and you've already alluded to this earlier in the interview, you talk about memories and either planting memories or erasing memories. Tell us about this aspect of the book and where you came up with that idea.
Well, the secret that lawyers know that juries don't know is that eyewitness testimony is really the least reliable form of testimony, and juries put the most weight on it. And there's just a lot of studies out there, many of which I cite in the book, that shows our memories work in a way, Calvin, where we know fact A and we know fact Z, but everything else in between, we just kind of recreate based on the assumption that it has to be that way because we remember fact A and fact Z. And
right.
Once we recreate it in our minds, we can't segregate out what we've recreated versus what really happened. We think what we recreated actually happened. And so they'll show people pictures of themselves in Disney World, which have been photoshopped. You know, here you are as a 6-year-old visiting Disney World with your parents. Do you remember anything about that trip? And people will go on in great detail describing the trip, having never been to Disney World. And so there's just lots of studies like that about false memory. And so my thinking is, what is an advocate's job? An advocate's job is to convince someone to see this case from their perspective. And are there principles that we can glean, psychological principles that we can glean from the way false memories are created, which would allow a lawyer or a psychologist to plant thoughts, to plant memories in someone's mind, almost like that movie Inception, you know, ask that same kind of question. But this is more real world than that. This isn't doing it through someone's dreams. This is using accepted psychological principles based on real life stories. So that's where I kind of came up with that aspect of the book.
That's really interesting.
Now, we talked a little bit earlier about the premise for this book being that the prisoners, they brought the justice system to the halt by refusing plea bargains. So we talked a little bit about it, but do you think this could ever really happen?
I hope not, Melissa, because I would hate to see it happen and have somebody say, "Oh, it's because of your book," you know. And probably not, because criminal defendants, they just don't trust each other that much. That's why they're always copping a plea and, you know, squealing on the other person.
No but honor among book, thieves.
Yeah, exactly. No honor among thieves. But in the book, my hypothesis is that it's brutally enforced. You know, if you do plea bargain, you come back to your jail cell, you're going to get killed by one of the gangs. And if you get released, you're on the streets, you get killed. And after two or three instances like that, the others, you know, they get the idea, we better adhere to this. I think the best way I can answer that question is, if they ever did do it, it really would create total chaos, because prisoners are entitled to speedy trials under the Constitution. And our system just isn't designed to give everybody a trial. It's designed to try about 10% of the cases. But I think the good news for us law-abiding folks is that it could probably never happen, because it requires too much cooperation among folks who are by nature cynical, untrustworthy, and looking out for themselves, not the greater good of the group.
So,
I mean,
go ahead. Melissa?
Oh, no, I was going to let you go on.
Oh, I was just going to ask the next question. What's next for you? I mean, this book is, you know, in the can, so to speak. What do you, we know you're always working on something else. I would dread the day when you say, you know what, I'm done. we dread that day. What's next for you in terms of writing? Are you doing another legal thriller, or are you going to do like an Amish romance?
That's great. I'm planning on doing another legal thriller, but you never know, those Amish romances are selling really well these days. Basically, this thing with Joe Paterno has caused me to start thinking. That's what happens. Events happen, you start thinking about things. And one of the things I've thought about is loyalty is a virtue, but sometimes loyalty can be a vice. You know, if you can be loyal to a fault, you've heard that saying, and that can be true. So my protagonist in the next book is a former SEC quarterback who goes to jail for point shaving, gets out of jail, becomes a lawyer, turns over a new leaf and says, I'm going to be loyal to this new firm. I'm going to be a good teammate. I've learned my lesson. When he gets to this new firm, the lawyers in the firm start dying from the senior partner down. And at first it looks accidental, but then everybody realizes this is just too coincidental. Somebody's taking down all the lawyers in this firm. And it's kind of like the Hotel California, you know, you can leave the firm as a lawyer, but you still end up dying. And this poor guy who's come to this firm is now seeing all of his partners die. He's inheriting their cases, what clients stay with the firm. He's in way over his head on these cases, and he's got to figure out who wants all the firm lawyers dead. What case has caused this in the firm's past that somebody's doing what Shakespeare said, you know, first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers. And so my protagonist, Landon Reed, is trying to try the biggest cases of his life he really shouldn't be doing, and at the same time try and save his own life and figure out who wants him dead. And I've called the book The Curse, because people look at this firm and say, who would want to work there? That firm is cursed. And that's what I'm working on next.
Wow, okay. That sounds really good.
Yeah, it does.
I'm having a lot of fun with it.
I can't wait to read that one. That sounds great.
And Melissa, you'll be glad to know that's a male protagonist, so I'm back in comfortable water.
Where can readers find out more about you and your books?
My website is randysinger.net, and you know, you can find out as much as you want to know about me there. And then the books are local Christian bookstores, local, you know, Barnes & Nobles, Amazon, wherever fine books are sold, or books like mine.
But not Borders, unfortunately.
Not Borders, right. Not anymore.
Unfortunately. Too soon. Randy, thank you so much for hopping on the line with us. It's always a pleasure to catch up with you and spend time, you know, kind of picking your brain about all things legal thriller. So, again, thanks so much for taking time to answer our questions for us.
Y'all are a lot of fun. Time goes fast when I'm on the phone with you guys. Thanks so much for letting me be part of this.